Bobby Collin.
So, first of all, thank you. Thank you all for coming out. Thanks for bringing me down to my second home of New Orleans. And, you know, thank you to Mark Davis, who reached out and invited me to come do this, and was persistent about it, even when I didn't believe in myself about it. But yeah, thanks so much. I always feel honored and unworthy to speak to any New Orleans audience, just because I believe that New Orleans has more to teach the world than anybody coming to try to teach New Orleans anything. But thank you. I had a certain introduction written that I had to change based off of my Uber ride into New Orleans today. I had a really interesting Uber driver. It was a woman who had just, she used to live in New Orleans, but she moved away from New Orleans a few years before Katrina. It was for work, it was for a job. She was going to move back to New Orleans, but then Katrina happened. And so she ended up staying in Alpharetta, Georgia, which is where she was, and she ended up staying in Alpharetta, you know, all the way until last year. I believe she said she moved back last year. She's living in Jefferson Parish. She has a daughter who went to college here at Xavier University. And her daughter actually ended up moving to another city because she didn't think that she could find a job here. And she was also tired of her home flooding. And so it was just a really interesting talk that I had with this woman. And I asked her, my driver, you know, if she felt that, you know, I asked the very controversial question of, do you think that certain neighborhoods should not be built back because of their being prone to flooding? And she said that all the neighborhoods absolutely should be built back, because she believed that the levees and the pumps and all of the technology that they were working right, that everything would be fine, you know, and that was the reason why everything should be brought back. And so I took a few things away from that conversation. She's not the first person I've heard make that case. And what is that, you know, there is definitely a trust among a lot of people, and it's not just in New Orleans, that technology is supreme. You know, that it's fail-proof, and that it can weather all elements, and you know, as long as all the technology is working, then there's nothing to worry about, right? The second thing that I took away from that conversation is that there seems to be a certain message that the city and the state and the country is giving to a lot of people, particularly its poor and vulnerable communities, which is that, you know, that where you live technically is safe, you know, and you can trust us on that. The other thing that I took away from that was that, you know, there are people who are willing to face realities around economics and jobs, and they're willing to relocate based off of that. They don't have faith in New Orleans' ability to provide them a good job. You know, they will face that reality. This is what my driver did, and this is what her daughter did. But they're not willing to face the same realities around weather or climate change or water. And so it all kind of reminds me, or brought into perspective for me, on a story that I did in August for CityLab.com, which was, it was supposed to come out on Katrina, it came out on Katrina, on the Katrina 12-year memorial, and it was a story I had been working on for a while. Literally in the middle of me writing it, Hurricane Harvey came and hit Houston. But I used to live in New Orleans. And when I moved here in 2009, I really couldn't find very few people still living here who would say that New Orleans should not be saved or could not be saved. 12 years later, in August, while I was recording the story I'm talking about, that seemed to be the only thing that I was hearing, you know, that perhaps New Orleans wasn't worth saving. And it was a really weird transition for me to hear these kinds of statements. Most of the people who I spoke to had already left New Orleans, many of the people I spoke to had already left New Orleans, and they did so because they were trying to find jobs. Some had left after Katrina, during Katrina, and they decided not to come back because of all that they had lost in the floods. The week before my article came out, The Gambit published an article, and you all probably heard about it. It blatantly asked the question, is New Orleans worth it, right? This was an article about the job situation and whether young professional millennials were able to hack it here in New Orleans. On the question of whether New Orleans is worth it, I just want to bring up the lives of three people who were very dear to me when I lived here in New Orleans. And I'll never stop talking about them because their lives mean a lot to me. One person who's a very dear friend, one of the first people I met when I moved to New Orleans, on the question of is New Orleans worth it, she would say, hell yeah, it's worth it. Her name was Deb Cotton. And, Deb, her entire life work, her entire life work was based off the idea, the fact, that New Orleans was definitely worth it. She worked and lived to preserve the culture of New Orleans. She was shot during the Mother's Day parade. She passed away recently. And anytime anyone brings up the question of whether New Orleans is worth it, even if we're looking at it from a technical perspective or a political perspective, I'm always gonna go back to Deb and the example that she set with her life and saying and answering that it was. Another loved one, another friend of mine, was a kid. His name was George Carter. He was a member of an organization called Rethink New Orleans Schools. You all heard of Rethink New Orleans? Yeah. Yes, okay, good, all right. My wife used to run Rethink a few years ago. That's how I met George. George was this young man who had, I'll never forget, he had this beautiful vision of what he thought needed to happen in New Orleans, and which was, he said that we need to create gardens all throughout the city. Gardens, especially around schools and homes, so that kids and families can go there and be at peace and meditate and reflect, and it would help them with their stress and the anxieties and the insecurities and frustrations of living in the city. So George was killed 3 years ago. He was only 13. He had a life full of promise, and it was a life that was cut short. I don't know that New Orleans was in a position to help fulfill that promise that George had. This is a city, for better or worse, that's known for locking up young African American kids like George. The last very dear person to me, whose life I want to talk about, is a friend of mine. His name is Rafael Delgadillo. He used to work with Puentes here. He also was shot here in New Orleans. He survived and he is still living, but he's not living in New Orleans. He's living in California right now and studying his PhD. He's a very smart, of Dominican descent, Latino man, and he was a very valuable asset here in New Orleans. But he left New Orleans not because of violence or even necessarily what happened to him. He left because he couldn't find a job for somebody of his skill set. I bring all of these people's names and lives of, because I'm trying to set a broader context for displacement and all of the ways that people are displaced here in New Orleans. I spoke with Raphael for the story that I mentioned that I worked on, and he told me that displacement for a Latino like him was inevitable. And I just want to read a quote from him. He said, "The biggest problem with New Orleans is that it's in Louisiana. A city like this, with the cultural heritage and landscape that it has, would thrive in any other state. Other states wouldn't let a city like that rot away. There would be a political and cultural vision developed to make it the flagship of the state." And that was his perspective. He just didn't have faith that the city was looking out for the safety and the security of someone like him. And it made me think of this question, all three of them, is, you know, what does it mean to grow up and live under the question or the idea that your displacement is inevitable? I just need to ask, do any of you think about this on a daily basis? Is this something that crosses your mind, that my displacement might be inevitable? Okay, I see a hand up. I'm an African American. I lived here, but I grew up in Pennsylvania, mostly from a middle class background. I don't know what it means to live with that reality every day, that my displacement is inevitable. That any given second, I might be gone. I have to leave. I was trying to think about, like, what kind of mentality, what kind of person does that make? And I came to these ideas. It must mean that you have to develop a mindset that says you can overcome anything, you know, be it floods or be it death. Or it means that you put all of your trust in the government, you know, even if that same government is failing you again and again and again. Or you put your hope in something else like technology or religion or culture, and you make these your saving grace. And so the question I came to is, so what is the country's obligation, and what is the city's obligation, what's New Orleans' obligation to those for whom displacement seems inevitable? That is their daily reality. You know, and I also can't help but wonder, you know, what could Deb, what could George, what could Raphael have been if they didn't daily have to think about their displacement as an inevitability? You know, what else could they have been dreaming about? What could they have been planning for their lives? Fast forward to what happened as I was writing my story in Houston. Hurricane Harvey hits, and I was speaking with a bunch of people in Houston who I know have been working in the environmental justice community, people I've been talking to for years, people who knew that, you know, I mean, not only did they live with these constant floods, but they had been reporting on all these problems. Robert Bullard, who is the godfather of environmental justice, his very first book was called Invisible Houston, and that was 30 years ago. It was specifically on the issue of what happens when you marginalize an entire community and put them in harm's place, and there's no policy to protect them. I spoke with him. I spoke with Hilton Kelly, who lives in Port Arthur, which is right off the coast, east of Houston. He's had to evacuate from his home at least a half dozen times in the last 10 years. Every time that hurricane hits Houston and he evacuates, I find myself in the same place talking to him. He runs an EJ nonprofit called Community Empowerment Development Association. I pose the question, you know, how much longer can this go on, you know? He is among a number of environmental justice advocates who for years has advocated for the preservation of Black communities, Native American communities, and Latino communities across the Gulf. He goes back and forth between leaving and staying for good. At the time when I talked to him, he actually was here in New Orleans. He had to leave. He has a home in Port Arthur. He has a business. When I talked to him, it was during his evacuation. You know, he was questioning whether he was going to go back to Port Arthur, which he had questioned many times before. Today, he's actually running for mayor of Port Arthur, so I guess he's going to stay. But these are the kinds of things that, you know, that these people are faced with. He gave me this quote for the story, you know, where, you know, when we talked about the possibility of him leaving or being displaced, and he said, you know, when I leave here, I don't own anything. I don't own anything in Dallas. I don't own anything in Colorado, in New York City, and I can't imagine buying a restaurant or a home there in this present situation. And so, you know, what Hilton is stuck with is he's in this conundrum that the low cost of living that he's referring to and that he enjoys is actually what keeps him in Port Arthur, but it's the living costs. The living costs where he lives are low precisely because he lives in a place that is vulnerable to disaster. And this is the conundrum that a lot of people of color live with. People I've spoken with for years, I've been covering environmental justice communities for at least 15 years now, and it's this exact same paradox, right? We live here because the rent is cheap. You know, we live here because my mother passed his home down to me. My father passed his business down to me. And I don't think that we could survive anywhere else. But it's precisely because of their unique proximity to disaster that they're able to enjoy those kinds of living standards. And it can't be ignored that many people of color, like Hilton or like, you know, people in the Ninth Ward or wherever, they're living in these places not because they chose to live there. They're living there because they had no choice but to live there. The main culprit for why people of color live in the most dangerous neighborhoods is the historical legacy of redlining, where African Americans, people of color, they couldn't get a loan to get a house uptown or somewhere that's above ground. They were forced by city policy and by federal policy to live in the least desirable areas and the places that were most prone to disaster. The Federal Housing Administration, which, you know, preceded HUD, they were the main driver of not only redlining, but also precisely the kinds of policies that made communities of color vulnerable to disasters. And it was there was a pamphlet that the Federal Housing Administration administered back in the 50s. It was called Planning Profitable Neighborhoods. And in that pamphlet, they broke down what was considered the characteristics the urban characteristics that made for good development, which means you should finance, you should lend in these neighborhoods, and what made for bad. The good neighborhoods were green, the bad neighborhoods were red, hence the name redlining. So in this pamphlet, when they determined the criteria for what was good, this was in the 50s, they said, you know, neighborhoods with large lots, places with discontinuous streets, places with strip malls, basically anything with a lot of pavement, right? And they got, those kinds of areas got grade A green lighting for lending. Susan Rogers wrote in the blog Offsite, in effect, the combined policies and practices, such as redlining, ensure that central cities, mixed-use areas, and neighborhoods of color would decline. So communities of color got all of the flooding, all the storm runoff, all the lack of working water infrastructure, but they had nowhere to go. They couldn't move to any other neighborhoods. This meant that their displacement was literally by design, even today, and which is why so many people live with the idea that their displacement is inevitable. And so I come back to this question, you know, what is the city's obligation to those people? What is the country's obligation to those people? I'm just gonna rattle off a few recommendations, but one, I would think that, you know, the cities or the country, they could mandate livable wages so that these families have more options about where to live. The federal minimum wage has not changed since 2009. It's $7.25, which is absolutely unlivable. Cities need to be real with people and admit that they can't promise their safety and their security, especially those who have been marginalized to the most disastrous neighborhoods. Cities need to admit that there's no technology, there's no wall, there's no levee, there's no pump station that they can build that can prepare them for the unknowns. And if there's any salient feature of climate change, it is that there are unknowns that will continue to happen. They need to be real and admit to people of color that the reason why they live in such insecurity and under the constant threat of displacement is because that's where the city put them, you know? And it was because of racism, for no other reason. Instead of sending messages of hope and resilience, just give them straight talk on equity, which means prioritizing the most vulnerable in all the master plans, all the proposals, all the strategies, and all the initiatives. And so, I guess we don't know, you know, what's in New Orleans' proposal for Amazon for the new HQ2, the new headquarters. And I genuinely hope that New Orleans gets it, for the record. My city, Pittsburgh, has pulled out a bunch of stops, but I mean, I'm rooting for New Orleans, you know, for better or worse. But I understand what comes with that if Amazon did come, or what could come with that. So, you know, applying some of these ideas, I just wanna, this is what I would hope that the city's proposal would look like. First of all, I think that, you know, obviously livable wages for all, starting from the bottom, the janitors, whoever it is that they would hire, and including prioritizing those left out of the workforce for those entry-level jobs. Second, you know, I would say no tax breaks or subsidies. I know that this is why I could never submit a proposal to Amazon. But yeah, no tax breaks or subsidies to the company that could be better used for improving the lives of the most vulnerable. Amazon contributing to the preservation and improvement of the water infrastructure in the city, but also the cultural infrastructure. That way, my friend Deb's life would not be in vain. Contributing, also Amazon should contribute to the building of gardens around the city. Not paved lots, but gardens, so that when there is rain and there's flood, you have these permeable surfaces that could soak up some of that. And also so that my friend George's life would not be in vain. And lastly, that they would be intentional about targeting African Americans and Latinos, you know, especially those with master's degrees, PhDs, and high skills for their jobs. That way, my friend Raphael could come back to New Orleans as he wants to do, and he would finally feel secure in the city. And that's my platform for running for mayor for New Orleans.